So I'm going to talk about lies and how they can kind of insinuate themselves into our lives and subvert the truth. I won't talk about the opposite of spirit per se, but I guess the opposite of truth. So the passage that Dr. Tubal had mentioned was John 4, 13 through 26, and I'm going to read that first here. Well, I guess it's the full chapter, but let me see. Where do I want to start from? I guess I'm going to just start in 13 through 26, but he's in the middle of his talking with the Samaritan woman. Jesus answered her, "Everyone who drinks of this water will thirst again, but whoever drinks of the water that I will give him will never thirst again, but the water that I will give him will become in him a well of water springing up to everlasting life." The woman said to him, "Sir, give me this water so that I do not get thirsty, neither come all the way here to draw." Jesus said to her, "Go call your husband and come here." The woman answered and said to him, "I have no husband." Jesus said to her, "You said well, I have no husband, for you've had five husbands, and he whom you have now is not your husband. This you have said truly." The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped in this mountain, and you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." Jesus said to her, "Woman, believe me, the hour comes when neither this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship that which you do not know. We worship that which we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour comes, and now is, when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and truth, for the Father seeks such to be his worshipers. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth." The woman said to him, "I know the Messiah comes. He is called Christ. When he has come, he will declare to us all things." Jesus said to her, "I am he, the one who speaks with you." So a few things kind of stood out to me when I went through that chapter or that section of verses. The first being that Jesus presents the Samaritan woman with an opportunity to embrace truth, but it's also awkward because he kind of, sets her up with, "Bring your husband here." And she can either kind of, make some kind of excuse or kind of try to distort reality of the way she's living. But she doesn't, and she answers truthfully that she doesn't have a husband. I guess she could have been a little more forthright in laying out her whole life and her problems to him. But at least she didn't, try to, lie. And I think God often puts us into situations where he's looking for our response to whatever it is to see if we're going to embrace truth or if we're going to try to lie to ourselves or to others that are also in the situation with us. So I think that's a pretty typical thing that God's going to do to test whether we're allied with truth or willing to tell a white lie to get out of a situation. It's also good to note that she doesn't get angry when she's confronted with the fact that she's had five husbands and is currently not living with a husband. And that kind of brought to mind the question for me of, are we angered when we are confronted with a lie that we're caught in, or maybe not even a lie, but confronted with a truth that we don't want to acknowledge? Is that something that we're upset about or unwilling to admit our wrongdoing? So I think that's something that is hard to see in the moment, but if we reflect on times when we've been confronted about something and our anger is aroused, it's good to look at those things and see whether it's because, I'm personally affronted by something that's true, or is it because, maybe you do have a legitimate reason to be angry because somebody's slandering you or doing something legitimately wrong. But I think oftentimes we can kind of discern the lies we've embraced in our own lives when we look at places where we are angry at somebody else or God, because that's an area where we've embraced a falsehood and are not living in the truth and aren't willing to admit that to ourselves. So the other thing I would say is to worship in spirit and truth is to do so without, affect, ritualistically, or through reliance on an intermediary or a location. So I think worshiping in spirit and truth is different from the Old Testament form of worship in that it's done, you know, spirit to spirit, our spirit and God's spirit. It's not done through a priest who is then going to go to God on our behalf, and it's not done by going to Jerusalem or, as this woman was talking about, the mountain that they're at in Samaria. It's done everywhere we are, we are able to do it, and it's done personally between ourselves and God and not through an intermediary of some sort. And this brought to mind the passage in Hebrews 6, 14 through 16, which says, well, maybe I have the wrong passage here. Yeah, I don't think that's what I wanted. Well, strike that. I don't remember even what I was going to reference there, but it's probably something 6, 14 through 16. So I'll go on to my next point here. I then looked into this definition of spirit, which I believe in the Greek is to mean the vital principle by which a body is animated, the rational spirit, the power by which a human being feels, thinks, and decides, or the soul. So this kind of just is to reinforce the idea of that is the thing that is interacting with God's spirit. It's our rationale, our feelings, our thoughts, our will, the thing that decides, our soul, is what is worshiping God. It's not necessarily doing this number of steps of different practices, killing this lamb on this given day. That's not what is worship necessarily. It's the human being that is deciding and acting and rationally yielding its will to do God's will. So I think that comes into play when it says in spirit, God is worshipped by spirit, like spirit to spirit. It's not something that's done differently than that. So verse 23 of the previous passage back in John 4, that's kind of along the same line. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship in spirit and truth. It's something that has to be done, like I've been saying already, with our spirit. It's not something that we can rely on culture or tradition to do our worship on our behalf. We can't just be culturally Christian and expect that to be a way of worshiping God accurately. In the Old Testament, we see instances of man using some other intermediary to worship God. They use Moses to interact with God. They use, the whole priestly structure as their go-between. And then even in the act of worshiping the golden calf, that's substituting something else for a way of worship instead of interacting personally with God as well. So worshiping in truth indicates that there's nothing false between us and God, no pretenses for other people's sakes, and no self-deception. If you're worshiping with no barrier between you and God, God's going to be able to see where we're being false, and when we're in his presence, we're going to be under his scrutiny, and there's nothing that is false that can be taken into God's presence and remain out of the light. So as we come into God's presence, all falseness within us is going to be exposed, and everything that's dark in us will be burned away in his light. So it's kind of, I don't know if it's a chicken and egg thing, because obviously as we come to God, we have areas of sin in our lives, but as we do so, enter into his presence, those things will be burned away from our lives, all that's false, and eventually we're going to be pure, and there will be nothing between us and God, because everything that's false will be exposed to his light and truth will be brought into the situation. I then kind of went into, it brought up the John 18, which is the lead up to Jesus' crucifixion. And I think that came up to mind because of what Pilate says in that section where he says, what is truth, when he's talking with Christ. So I'm going to read John 18. Let me see where I want to start. Yeah, no, I'm going to read a bunch of this section. Kind of the so to set the stage, I'm just looking at the whole passage from the viewpoint of where are people lying and how and what ways are they lying. The lead up to Jesus' arrest is Judas living in falsehood because he's already decided to betray Christ, which is one of the worst forms of falsehood. You're pretending to be someone's friend and then ultimately betraying them to be crucified. And the reason for Judas's being a double agent is that he was called out for his greed, and because he complained and rebuked Mary for using the costly ointment on Christ, and Jesus rebukes him, and from that point forward, he looks for a way to betray Christ. So greed was the incentive for Judas to be false to Christ, and I think greed is often a root cause for us compromising for our truth. So people will do something gray or shady that's because they want to get something for themselves, whether it be monetary greed or greed for, I don't know, any other form of wealth. And they'll compromise on truth so that they can get wealth in this given area at that point in time instead of staying true to what God has called them to. So I think Judas's betrayal is actually a pretty common way that Christians betray the gospel or Christ. They compromise on different things because they want something at that given point in time instead of remaining true to what God would have them do in that situation. And another pretty common one is fear, but I'll cover that a little down the road here. And I would also point out that when Judas is called out for rebuking Mary, his response is unlike the woman at the well. The woman at the well is receptive to Christ's rebuke, whereas Judas immediately, you know, has the opposite reaction of betraying Christ. All right. So I guess as we look through this section, there's different ways people betray Christ. Let me just read it here. I'm going to start in... I'll just start in verse 1. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went out with his disciples over the Wadi of the Kidron, where there was a garden into which he and his disciples entered. Now Judas, who betrayed him, also knew the place, for Jesus often met there with his disciples. Judas, then, having taken a detachment of soldiers and officers from the chief priests and the Pharisees, came there with lanterns, torches, and weapons. Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that were to happen to him, went forth and said to them, "Who are you looking for?" They answered him, "Jesus the Nazarene." Jesus said to them, "I am he." Judas also, who betrayed him, was standing with them. When, therefore, he said to them, "I am he," they went backward and fell to the ground. Just a couple things right off the bat there is that the people going to arrest Jesus know they're in the wrong and aren't willing to admit it, obviously. And just the effect of Jesus standing for the truth and not being, like, it would be the temptation for a fallen human being to be like, Jesus, I saw him go that way, you know, instead of being like, I am he. You have a detachment of people looking for you with weapons and such, but Jesus is not going to compromise on truth, and he speaks the truth. And this is actually something that astonishes them. They like fall back in astonishment from him. So I think truth has power, and I think it's also something when we have courage and stand for the truth, it's a testimony to others who see that and are able to stand with you when they see you standing for truth. Um, then, let's go on here. Verse 7. Again, therefore, he asked them, "Who are you looking for?" They said, "Jesus the Nazarene." And Jesus answered them, "I tell you that I am he. If therefore you seek me, let these go their way, that the word might be fulfilled which he spoke, 'Of those whom you have given me, I have lost none.' Simon Peter, therefore, having a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant and cut off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. Jesus therefore said to Peter, 'Put the sword into its sheath. Am I not to drink the cup which the Father has given me?'" I think in this section, it's pretty clear that Simon Peter is, he's afraid. He's either afraid or he's super, arrogant in that he can defeat a whole detachment of soldiers. And he acts out of this by, you know, going into violence. Whereas I think if he had been taking his leading from Jesus, he would have, you know, been peaceful and, not given into this fear that he had. And what it was is he was believing a lie. He was falling for a lie that if he didn't act, then, you know, maybe they would all die, or maybe Jesus would be crucified, which he was anyway. But the fact is, people will act out of fear, and fear is the result of believing a lie. You're believing either a fear of that, God isn't sufficient and I have to act out of my own strength to get something done, or you're believing a lie that that God isn't there to provide for you in some way, shape, or form, and then acting out of that. So I think fear and truth are linked in that fear is a result of believing a lie of some sort when you get down to the root of it. So the detachment, the commanding officer and the officers of the Jewish leaders seized Jesus and bound him and led him to Ananias first, the father-in-law to Caiaphas, who was the high priest that year. Now it was Caiaphas who advised the Jewish leaders that it was expedient that one man should perish for the people. Simon Peter followed Jesus, as did another disciple. Now that disciple was known to the high priest and entered with Jesus into the court of the high priest. But Peter was standing at the door outside. So the other disciple, who was known to the high priest, went out and spoke to her who kept the door and brought in Peter. Then the maid who kept the door said to Peter, "Are you also one of this man's disciples?" And he said, "I am not." Now the servants and the officers were standing there, having made a fire of coals, for it was cold. They were warming themselves. Peter was with them, standing and warming himself. The high priest therefore asked Jesus about his disciples and about his teaching. Jesus answered him, "I spoke openly in the world. I always taught in synagogues, in the temple, where all the Jewish people came together. I said nothing in secret. Why do you ask me? Ask those who heard what I spoke to them. Surely they know what I said." Again, this is Jesus just being blatant and open with the truth, and the high priest being disingenuous and trying to trap Jesus in some kind of blasphemy. And it's just a whole sham of them, you know, not seeing the lie that they're believing, and that they are trying to trap Jesus because they're afraid for their own power and authority. So everybody in this story, aside from Jesus, is acting out of some sort of deceit or out of some sort of lie that they have in their mind because of some sort of fear or some sort of conniving that they want to get something for their own ends. And I think it's just pretty apparent just how false everybody's motives in this story are, aside from Jesus. When he had said this, one of the officers standing by slapped Jesus with his hand, saying, "Do you answer the high priest like that?" Jesus answered him, "If I have spoken evil, testify of the evil. But if well, why do you beat me?" So in that interaction, you kind of see it. Like, this officer is so affronted because of a lie he's embraced that he, like what Nathan was talking about, he's bought whatever the high priest have said, hook, line, and sinker, and he's not discerning at all. I mean, there might be something in it for him, that's why he's so on board with it, but even if he's just a stooge who, believes because of what the high priest is saying, he's believing a lie because it is something that helps him in some way, shape, or form, or because it's out of fear of some sort. Then Ananias sent him bound to Caiaphas the high priest. Now Simon Peter was standing and warming himself, and they said therefore to him, You are not also one of those disciples, are you? He denied it and said, I am not. One of the servants of the high priest, being a relative of him whose ear Peter had cut off, said, Did I not see you in the garden with him? Peter therefore denied it again, and immediately the rooster crowed. Peter's really embracing a lie here. On the one hand, his motives are pure in that he wants to be with Jesus, but on the other hand, he's not willing to go the extra mile of being out front with his faith in Jesus and his allegiance to Jesus. He's denying him multiple times here. Let me see if I have notes here. Oh, I skipped over one thing that I thought was actually pretty good. Back in verse 4, where this whole thing starts in the garden, it says, Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that were happening to him, went forth and said to them, Who are you looking for? I think one thing that gives us confidence and power in a situation is knowing what's going to befall us. And we might not know to the same extent that Jesus knew what was going to befall him, but we know broad strokes what's going to befall us, and that's we're going to share eternity with Jesus. And if that's something that we truly believe, then we won't be tempted by lies to, have self-preservation of some sort or to gain man's approval as opposed to God's approval. We'll be instead motivated by our knowledge that God is going to see us through any situation and that the ultimate reward is going to far outweigh any suffering that we're going to face along the way. So I guess just the encouragement that if we come to a place of real belief that everything that God has in store for us is going to be for our good ultimately, then we can have boldness when we're confronted with something that's on the face of it horrific. Let's see. I think another thing that comes out in this section is about Peter warming himself by the fire is I think Peter is mainly afraid of exposure and being known as Jesus' disciple, but it also kind of comes off a little bit like shame of association with Christ. And I think you can see this, like the thing that came to mind for me was, I know growing up, like if you were the group of cool kids and you had some kind of, I don't know, it could be like a family thing that you believed or whatever, you'd almost be tempted to not bring it up or to say that it's, deny it like Peter's doing here. Like, oh no, we don't, say prayer before every meal or something like that because you want to appear cool. I think that's another source of reason for people to lie is because they want to be on the in crowd. They want to be approved of by others or accepted by the community. So I think that's another thing that we should be aware of is if we're compromising and not standing for the truth because of our desire for approval from others, then we should change in that area. I think it's also notable that Jesus is very frank and reasonable. Everything he says, like with his interaction with the officer, is just blatant, uncontestable truth of, I was out in public, I said these things. If there's something that I said that's contestable, bring it up to me. And it's met with, just being beaten. And I think that's pretty indicative of the lengths to which this officer was bought into the lie. He wasn't willing to at all consider reason or truth or any substantive argument. And I think it's, broadly speaking, true that standing for the truth is going to make you a target for people who embrace lies. So not to say that we should always, if you're not being beaten, you're not doing a good job. but it's not necessarily a bad thing for you to be taking hardship in the world, because that can be indicative that you are taking a stand for what's right. Again, as Nathan was talking about, you should be discerning as to whether you're just being problematic for the sake of being problematic also. Okay. Let's see. I guess we'll pick it up again in verse 28. They led Jesus, therefore, from Caiaphas into the praetorium. It was early, and they themselves did not enter the praetorium, that they might not be defiled, but might eat the Passover. Pilate therefore went out to them and said, "What accusation do you bring against this man?" I love this verse 30. So they answered him, "If this man weren't an evildoer, we would not have delivered him up to you." It's like the shallowest argument ever. but it just kind of shows, you know, the lengths to which, and I think you can see that in the modern society in general, people will say, there's different social things that are happening, and people will say, well, you know, they're in jail because, you know, if they say they're a problem because they're in jail, not that, you know, they don't argue on the actual problem. They just say, well, if they hadn't been doing anything wrong, they wouldn't have been, you know, put in jail. Which is not a very substantive argument whatsoever, but I think there's a lot of different ways that's happening in today's society in terms of people seeing a punishment and therefore inferring a crime. Let's see. 31. Pilate therefore said to them, "Take him yourselves and judge him according to your law." Therefore the Jewish leaders said to him, "It is not lawful for us to put anyone to death." So they want somebody else to do their dirty work for them, which I think is also kind of something you'll see with lies, is there's kind of a mob mentality of, if, you know, the state or some authority does it on our behalf, then they can wipe their consciences clean and say, oh, you know, it was the right thing because, you know, it was out of our hands and they did something wrong. That's people lying to themselves about their culpability in persecuting or disparaging another individual. Pilate therefore entered again into the praetorium, called Jesus, and said to him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" Jesus answered him, "Do you say this by yourself, or did others tell you about me?" I think this is also a pretty clever thing for Jesus to say. Nailing somebody down, especially in an argument about truth and lies, you can kind of see when people have just, you know, taken somebody else's argument and just broad strokes, you know, said it without having any substantive backing for it. I think Jesus calling out Pilate as to if he's thought through this or if he's just taking the Jews' say-so in the matter. Pilate just skirts around the question here. He says, "I am not a Jew, am I? Your own nation and chief priests delivered you to me. What have you done?" Jesus answered, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my servants would fight, that I would not be delivered to the Jewish leaders. But now my kingdom is not from here." Pilate therefore said to him, "Are you a king then?" Jesus answered, "You say that I am a king. For this reason I have been born, and for this reason I have come into the world, that I should testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth listens to my voice." Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" When he said this, he went out again to the Jewish leaders and said to them, "I find no basis for a charge against him, but you have a custom that I should release someone to you at Passover. Therefore, do you want me to release to you the king of the Jews?" Then they shouted again, saying, "Not this man, but Barabbas." Now Barabbas was a robber. This kind of just shows the lengths to which they are willing to go to achieve their own ends, to believe a lie that that somehow supports them in the short term of this world. They will take a harm over a good because they're so allied to a lie. In regards to Pilate, I kind of find him a little bit agnostic to the idea of truth. He kind of, like he says, what is truth? He kind of takes whatever the utilitarian route is of the least drama. He just wants the Jews to leave him alone. And he just passes off the responsibility for Jesus' fate. He basically doesn't have any spine. So he believes in the lie that the expedient route is the best route and follows the path of least resistance. And I think that's a lie that a lot of people fall prey to, is just go with the most expedient thing. Whatever's easiest in the moment is the route they'll take, instead of taking a long-term view and seeing that truth is going to ultimately give them the best result. So these are all instances of failing to worship God in spirit and truth. So another thought was that worship indicates sacrifice. It says in that John 4 chapter that God is looking for those who are going to worship him in spirit and truth. He's like actively searching for them. So if worship is sacrifice, it's operating under the belief that God is worthy of obedience regardless of the personal cost to us. We sacrifice ourselves to glorify God. We sacrifice our fallen nature and self-sufficiency and fear to do worship, to worship God. And that's kind of our act of worship, is to crucify these fallen attributes of ourselves, of fear, of self-sufficiency, of wanting the approval of others. We have to sacrifice all those things and pursue truth as opposed to those things and not be false to God. Romans 12, 1 through 2 says, if I can get there. Therefore, I urge you, brothers, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living sacrifice, wholly acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what is the good and acceptable and perfect will of God. That kind of surmises it, that we're sacrificing what we prefer to do in our own fleshly desires to pursue truth and God. So I think often we lie and practice falseness because we don't trust God to provide for us. As we mature in faith of God's character and provision, fears are replaced by truth, and we grow to be more and more like him. And then in regards to spirit and truth, we engage our will, which is our spirit, in believing God's truth, and we lay down our fear on the altar of faith, which is an act of worship. Worshiping God in spirit and truth is denial of our fallen proclivities to fear and conniving. In summary, I guess I kind of want to go through a few common lies that we believe and how that affects our worship of God. One common lie is that I need to do whatever this thing is or I won't have enough. So it's a fear of lack of provision. It's believing that I have to, out of my own strength, provide for myself. And the truth is that God will provide for us, like it says about the birds of the air. Another common lie is that it's okay to participate in ungodly language because I need to get along with other people. So fear of man. And the truth is that God wants us to be light and salt in our daily life. Another lie is that, you know, I deserve something because I've worked hard or whatever our justification is. And the truth is that everything that we have has been given to us and that we should honor God with our bodies. Another common lie in terms of speech is, like, people will justify gossip by saying it's not gossip if it's true. And the truth is that our speech should impart grace to the hearers, as it says in Colossians 4, 5, and 6. So I guess I would just encourage us all to consider where it is that we are angry about something or a given situation or at people, and just see if that's because it's calling out some sort of lie that we're believing in our lives, and see where it is that we need to confront lies in ourselves and revert to believing God's truth and acting out of that. So that's what I had.